Hello, I'm Professor Bob Hewish from the Department of International Development Studies at Dalhousie University. You're listening to GDP, the Global Development Primer, the podcast dedicated to all issues in international development studies. Follow me on Twitter at Professor Hewish. Hi again, welcome back to GDP, the Global Development Primer podcast. We have two fantastic guests who are also two fantastic authors joining us this week. We've got Ilan Kapoor, who is a professor of critical development studies at the Faculty of Environmental and Urban Change at York University in Toronto. And his research centers on psychoanalytical and post-colonial theory in politics, as well as ideology critique. He's the author of seven books, and his most recent are Confronting Desire, Psychoanalysis and International Development, that was in 2020, Universal Politics, 2022, and Global Libidinal Economy, which is in 2023. We also have Gavin Verdell joining us. He's a university research professor and chair of global development studies at St. Mary's University in Halifax, Nova Scotia. His research focuses on fair trade and free trade, global political economy, and critical social and psychoanalytic theory. He's published widely, including co-authoring with Ilan Kapoor, Rethinking Development Politics, and also with Ilan Kapoor, Maureen Seo, and Peter DeVries, Global Libidinal Economy. So here today, these two great authors are going to join us on GDP to talk about their latest work, which is Rethinking Development Politics. Gavin, Ilan, welcome to GDP.
Thanks. Thanks for having us.
Great. Thanks so much.
It's great to have you both back. You're both veterans of this podcast, one at a time, but now we've got you in tandem. And what a great opportunity to talk about your new book, which is about rethinking development politics. It's a timely title, but sort of the addendum to this is that it's about rethinking global development politics through a psychoanalytical lens. So could you take us through why that is? Why do we need to look at global development politics psychoanalytically?
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to begin and say that the reason psychoanalysis is an important perspective in our view is because it helps investigate the gaps, the contradictions, the unconscious desires of development. So for example, the fact that capitalism is built on inequality and environmental destruction, things that it is reluctant to acknowledge or even address in a serious way. Hence, our current climate crisis, for example. So if you don't mind, Bob, let me just take 3 or 4 minutes to provide some context and brief background to that statement so the rest of our discussion today makes some sense. And Gavin, I'm sure, will add. Psychoanalysis says that these gaps and contradictions that I just referred to are actually part and parcel, not just of capitalism or global development, but of the human condition, mainly because there's a mismatch between language, the stuff that we use to communicate, describe, and act in the world, a mismatch between that and material reality. And these holes, these antagonisms, these erasures in language are precisely the unconscious. But the problem is that rather than facing these gaps and contradictions, we are constantly trying to avoid them, fill them up, smooth them over. And we appear to have a relentless and uncontrollable urge for fullness, harmony, happiness. That is to fill those gaps, smooth over those contradictions. And that urge is what we call enjoyment, jouissance in French, unconscious enjoyment. And it is not just pleasure, but excessive, if not orgasmic pleasure. It helps explain, for example, why people engage in extreme sports such as skydiving or bungee jumping. I think we do them not despite the risks involved, but because of the risks involved, because they are accompanied by enjoyment, by a certain danger and a thrill all at once. And so to illustrate in terms of global development, let's take consumption, shopping. Shopping is premised on tempting us with a constant stream of attractive products, iPhones, cars, fast food, designer clothes. which never live up to their promise because they don't completely satisfy, they don't fill that gap. And as a result, the system keeps us coming back for more. So the system centers on seducing us with the prospect of total enjoyment, yet never being able to quite deliver. And this dynamic, this lure of postponed enjoyment is what sustains the whole system, is what sustains capitalist development. So just a couple more points. The implication, if you think about it, is quite devastating because it means that we act based not necessarily on what we know, but on this endless drive to enjoy. Knowledge, in other words, is often trumped, and I use that word advisedly, trumped by desire. So it's so excessive and seductive, this enjoyment. And so in the example of shopping that I just mentioned, people are well aware, especially in our internet and media age, are well aware of the severe global environmental consequences of consumption, pollution, carbon emissions, garbage, e-waste, but we still go ahead and consume to the point of overconsumption. And this is what psychoanalysis calls disavowal. It reveals our fetishization of shopping, our love for the bling on offer under capitalism, beyond the consequences. So briefly, then, to sum up, there are two main reasons for which we think psychoanalysis is important. One is that it allows us to do what we call ideology critique, that is, to uncover these gaps and contradictions, these unconscious desires that ideologies such as neoliberal capitalism are trying to cover up. And secondly, what psychoanalysis offers is the possibility of radical transformation. Because the excess of enjoyment, this drive to enjoy, while it may be a problem, it may also be a resource. And so drive has a certain excessiveness and rebelliousness to it. So, for example, one of the case studies we examine in our book is how a politics of drive is applicable to what's happening in current day Iran. The drive by the famous movement, Woman Life Freedom Movement, to try and topple the authoritarian clerical regime there. And I'll stop there. Maybe Gavin wants to add something.
Well, I think everything was covered great there. I mean, if I was to add only one thing, which is just clarifying what Alain already said, and if we think about development, but also if we think about modernization or global finance or global trade, I think what we're exploring in the book that way is why, you know, despite criticisms of these things, we never get away from them. We always get back to them. You know, there's that expression about how you may be done with the past, but the past isn't done with you. And I think that applies to development. You know, you may be done with development, but development isn't done with you. You know, so despite all these critiques of development over the last, you know, 15 years or beyond that, you know, we still have the Sustainable Development Goals, which are a major institution globally. We still have BRICS countries throughout the Global South that often go to great pains to point out how what they're doing is about economic development and sustainable development. And, you know, even last week, I noticed in the news that Ahmed Hussein, who's Canada's Minister of International Development, you know, announced a $120 million sovereign loan for Ecuador. Now, what that's going to involve, you know, it's about inclusive growth and green economy, sustainable development, things like this. We have to unpack that and critically analyze it like we always do. And I don't know much about this loan, but I'm just raising it to show you how, you know, you can't really get away from things like development, even though we say we've moved beyond them and then we come back to them.
Oh, wow, fellas, those are incredible points. And I mean, so important to actually dig at this right now, because as you say, we seem to just be in this interminable repetition of cycles. I mean, you know, we've all taught introduction to development studies at our respective universities. And you know, one of the lessons that I find is the most becoming is sort of when you go back into the 1990s, the shock doctrine, and you know, talk about what Jeffrey Sachs was promoting for getting sweatshops in Bangladesh, like really advocating that was the way to improve the human condition. And if he can, you know, you present that through to sort of their discourse, and you see the promises that are coming out with it, then you look at it in the rear view, and you see that none of that was lived up, and all sorts of corruption and humanitarian problems erupted from it. It just seems so obvious, but this consistency of never living up to the promise, Ilana, as you pointed out, that just seems to be an inherent part of the nature. So if we're able to kind of call this out, are there ways to get to a more radical transformation of these processes today?
Gavin?
I think that it's very difficult to get to a radical transformation. I think that, you end up back. So, I mean, your example with Saks is a great example. And then now these days we have a kind of inclusive growth, which in some ways is kind of repeating the same cycle, because now what it is, we recognize that there's all these predominantly women workers in certain supply chains working under relatively difficult conditions. Now we recognize that and talk about the inclusive growth that these women workers need, but we don't really do very much to pay them more and treat them better in their working conditions in the factories. So you end up with this perpetual cycle of things that we deny and disavow, but then we return to all over again. And I think that, there is radical ways to break free, but I think it has to start with recognizing, which I think sometimes progressives and those in development circles are not always good at, is recognizing just how powerful the appeal is to things like modernization, how powerfully people are drawn to them, and how they're drawn to them for things that I think aren't always strictly rational. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, the answer of a psychoanalytic politics is always, rather than disavowing these problems, let's face them. One, that's a first step. And I think that means defetishizing the system, right? The reason we disavow is because we unconsciously love the system, and we don't really want things to change. So the way to start to address this is defetishizing that, taking some remove from it, but also reorienting that towards other alternatives. Why is it that we always buy into a system that lives on inequality? Why do we not aspire to a system that is not built on inequality, for example? So reorienting our desires towards more progressive, liberatory fantasies and visions. That's the challenge, it seems to me.
It's great points, absolutely great points on this. And, for students especially who are kind of getting into these topics, I mean, one thing that I think your book, Rethinking Development Politics, is the way it's sort of laid out. I mean, your second chapter gets into what modernization was about. And you call it out that it's really kind of a cloak term for unbridled capitalist development. And this provides a really rich history of development. And that's, I've seen that as pretty standard, but the third chapter actually goes after neo-Marxist scholarship to some degree as actually failing to take that fetishism seriously. So, why is it that we can't call out our own fetishes, Ilan? I mean, this is something that you've kind of hinted at already in our discussion.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm actually going to pass that over to Gavin, who I'm pretty sure has a good answer, but I'll add. Go ahead, Gavin.
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, I think that, we're essentially critiquing neo-Marxist scholars, and I think Ilan and I would locate ourselves in that in a broad sense, but we're critiquing them for kind of having a strong criticism of modernization, but at the same time, still seeing capitalism as being something that's strictly about rational objectives and rational and in rational terms. So, they critique modernization by saying that, what capitalism is really about is extracting wealth from poor countries and funneling it to the rich ones. And Ilan and I 100% would agree with that and with the analysis on it. But, over-focusing on the strictly economistic and rational sides of that sometimes misses a lot. So, and this is, I think, why Ilan passed it off to me, is just to give you an example from the book, is this discussion we have with Patnick and Patnick's work on imperial drain. And they had done this really fantastic work where they're estimating how much economic value India has basically had siphoned off to Britain as a result of imperialism over the last 250 years. And they do this great work and they estimate it's 12.4 trillion pounds. But the political challenge with their analysis, I mean, we agree with that assessment, is that revealing that doesn't seem to lead to sort of like a radical political transformation that they call for. You know, so they say that exposing that should lead to a radical transformation when people see this kind of data, but it doesn't. And you know, in fact, in India, as we all know, there's Narendra Modi is the prime minister there, and he's as popular as ever. You know, and he's at the head of a Hindu nationalist movement that has lots of challenges to it, and it's also very much pro-capitalist and not really interested in radical change. So Patnaik and Patnaik recognize this, but all they can really do in their work is just acknowledge it and say, well, for some reason, people are duped by unreason, they say. But they say we need to keep pointing out this unequal economic value transfer, and that will lead to an alternative movement. So, I mean, the way Alan and I address this in our book is we say, well, the problem there is that capitalism is about unequal value, but it's also about enjoyment. Capitalism measures enjoyment like never before, you know? So you can have unequal economic growth globally, but you can also have an expansion of enjoyment. And we mean that enjoyment in the way that Alan described it at the beginning, with all the tensions that come with it. So, you know, Narendra Modi's been great at providing rural toilets and gas cylinders and all these things. A digital payment system for hundreds of millions of people in India, including the very poorest, so they can participate in a kind of digital technology-mediated economy. And he's also provided them much more dangerous kinds of pleasures, you know, for the majority Hindu population, a kind of a sort of pathological domination over the minority Muslim population. And so what we're trying to point out in our work is that these aren't side games. These aren't just on the margins of what's going on in India's political economy, but they're central to it. And we have to understand that the economic inequalities that India experiences vis-a-vis, say, rich countries has to also be understood in the way that capitalism meets temporarily people's desires, and often in really kind of, you know, undesirable ways. I don't know if you want to add to that, Alan.
Well, I mean, I would just say that also, you know, you're speaking to this global wave of neo-populism, which is happening in India, but also under Trump and Bolsonaro in Brazil and Duterte in Philippines and Orban in Hungary and so on and so forth. You know, we're witnessing a very unsettling time in our world. And people are looking for anchors. And I think one of the things that psychoanalysis helps explain is that these leaders in all of these countries, these neo-populist leaders, they've somehow latched on to this emotional deficit. And what they provide is a highly impoverished political vision, but a very effective one. And that is a way of unifying the nation, of projecting unity and harmony, you know, make America great again, and so on and so forth. And that, you know, Marxist political economy doesn't latch onto, because it avoids the emotional and the passionate. And I think, you know, and it's also one of the lacks of left politics, I think, is that left politics has tended to neglect the whole arena of political passions, and the right has been very effective in mobilizing it. So that is a challenge, I think, for the left, is how do we mobilize passions in a way that is progressive and just?
That Alan, sounds exactly like what, you know, even Gramsci wrote back in his day, was that would be right. The ultimate crisis of supporting, you know, Marxist movements was where's the passion, where's the pizzazz, where's that irrational imagined participation that society's supposed to give you. And I think you're right on. You know, these are fantastic points. And you know, I'm doing a book right now on stigma and COVID, and how governments were able to basically present very rational fact about what was going on in the world. But yet, just by the nature of that communication and just by what people were seeking in society, there was always irrational. There was always the emotional, the irrational thought that actually could grow and dominate and push that rationalism almost into the sidelines in some places. It's you know, the guest we have coming on next week after you guys is actually a comedian, professional comedian, Kyle Hickey. And he gets into this too a little bit, where we talk about in even when he's going to go do stand-up comedy, he finds that when you talk to people about the big politics or the obvious crisis, and you're on stage presenting this, people just sort of stare at it and go, don't know how to handle what's being said here. Or you call out just how, you know, blundering policy is coming out of one particular government. People sort of freeze at it, or they take a real defined position. But he finds that, you know, what we were talking about is that some of the moments where you can discuss the shared experience of the fetish or the suffering, that's where the comedy begins to lie. That's where people start to see that, oh, we are having this shared experience, and oh, these sort of superstructures around it may seem impossible, but we now have a space where we can commune. And in itself, that's where you have actually comedy becoming a political space. But my point is that it really does seem that that irrational can just push over the amount of bandwidth to that of the rational thought, or the big facts, or the big issues that are being presented.
In fact, the comedic and jokes are a very important part of psychoanalysis. Why? Because what jokes do is that they allow us to say things that we wouldn't ordinarily be able to admit. You know, as the joke is that you say one thing, but you actually mean your father or your mother, right?
Right.
And that's, you know, it shows up the irrationality within the rational, and that's that's one of the points of psychoanalysis, as we've been arguing.
Right, Gavin, do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, I think obviously I agree, and I think that's a challenge for the left to come up with alternatives that are seductive, you know, that really draw people in. And I think that it's also a challenge, I think, to live with tension. So, you know, I'll give you an example that just jumps my mind from this discussion. And I'll have this conversation in my first year development class around climate change and air miles. And, you know, you have a bunch of development students who, you know, love to travel, which I think is fine on some level, but aren't really willing to play with what that means for being concerned about local level development globally, while at the same time jetting around the world and contributing massively to carbon emissions that then, you know, destroy the sort of local and global environments of the communities that we're concerned about. And so, but what I say with the students is that, you know, it's so, then people always want to choose one easy way out by rejecting one thing and accepting something else. And I think what I encourage them to do is just live with the tension. Think of the tensions in their own lives. Understand the gap between what they would like the world to be and what they themselves are drawn to, their own desires. And I think in doing that, that might open up the door for them to have a kind of a bit more of an understanding for other people that they might not necessarily agree with. And that through that, build some solidarity.
That's a great point. That's a really, really great point, Gavin. That's sort of what the purpose of even academia more broadly is to live in with those tensions and to understand why they're occurring, rather than escape into the fetish and the phorias and that kind of realm.
Yes, and I think it's very true that people very quickly want to sort of use intellectual or even popular thinking to sort of align themselves in a side that's free from complicity. Whereas I think that what we're trying to do in our book is encourage people to explore complicity on a deeper level of themselves and others, and what that might open up messier doors, but ones that are more effective.
Right. So that kind of leads me to my last kind of point of discussion here. You know, we've mentioned a few times this season in the podcast, and as we all know, there's growing discussion within global development studies more broadly. And again, a lot of this has been with work done to look at decolonization and of the curriculum of the universities themselves. But, you know, there's some conferences and roundtables now talking about whether or not is development dead, right? Are we at to the point now where we got to throw the whole thing out, or do we even keep teaching it the way that we have? But I don't necessarily hear your book agreeing with the claim that development is dead. Instead, you know, what's the takeaway message from the work that you've done here? Where do we go next? As if it's towards a radical transformation, is it living intention? How do we approach our discipline better going forward?
I mean, let me say that we are absolutely on board with the whole project of decolonization. I mean, I think our book is about a decolonization. It's definitely about anti-capitalism, anti-colonialism, anti-racism, a pro-feminist book, a pro-indigenous book. But just like Fanon, Frantz Fanon, who was one of the very first to bring attention to the question of decolonization, we have several important, or what we see as important warnings, you know, in this direction. Because indeed, global development does have a criminal past, and we need to face that. But because of that, one tendency, as you mentioned, Bob, is the tendency to try and expunge the term development, or to get rid of the field itself. So, for example, some years ago, the idea was to rename and reformulate development studies as globalization studies, right? And we think this is a grave mistake, because the premise of that kind of thinking is that renaming and reorienting or reformulating the discipline will somehow enable a new and pristine start, free from past entanglements. But if psychoanalysis teaches us anything, it's all about the famous notion of the return of the repressed. Because I think the move to create a new discipline, once again, is just a fantasy aimed at covering over, at avoiding, disavowing, deflecting the inconveniences of development's history. So that only by confronting the field's crimes head on can we meaningfully decolonize it. So this is why we are determined in this book to dwell on development with all its inconvenient associations with coloniality and racism, ideological subordination, socioeconomic and cultural exploitation, and so on and so forth. And I think the same holds true for decolonial development and post-development, which are all the rage, as you said, in on our campuses these days, especially decoloniality. We like their critique, but we have many problems with what they advocate as alternatives, I think. And because the problem is that despite their critique of coloniality, which we agree with, the coloniality between the continuing patterns of coloniality between the North and the South, the problem is that what they end up proposing is a kind of naive, what they call pluriversality, that is the autonomy of the local, which is prioritized, which is ostensibly a good thing, but it's conceived in such a way as to yield to a kind of uncritical romanticization. They prioritize what they call non-Eurocentric forms of living and knowledge rooted in the Zapatistas in Mexico, indigenous groups in Ecuador and Bolivia, and so on and so forth. Okay, great. But then they end up constructing them as ideal spaces where there's social unity and harmony. People live and participate collectively. They live in harmony with nature and so forth. So our issue here is not with these local communities, but rather with people like Arturo Escobar and Walter Mignolo's construction of them as idealized depictions, because what this idealization disavows is all the not so good stuff. The Ecuadorian state co-optation of indigenous leaders, for example, Bolivia's compromises with multinational extractivist companies, ideological divisions between and among indigenous groups, and so on and so forth. So what is absent in these representations of the subaltern, of marginalized peoples, are the warnings of Fanon, once again, about the possibility of internalized repression, of co-optation, of racism, which we are all subject to, by the way, not just these communities. And hence the warnings about the responsibility of critical theorists such as Mignolo to be much more attentive to their representations of the subaltern, so as not to speak on behalf of them. So those are some of the dangers we are pointing to in this question of decolonization.
Well, that's fantastic, Ilan. Gavin, your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think if I was to add to what Ilan is saying, is that I think that we also have to be very careful about the fact that we can, as you know, scholars think our way out of development, which, as a land point, that we very much agree with that critique. But it's much harder to think your way out of capitalist development. So, you know, suddenly we're not necessarily charting the expansion and growth of capitalist development as the dominant development model still of our time. And so, you know, we have sections in the book where we talk about, you know, EV batteries and green modernization and digital modernization. Basically, the central point that we're charting is how, you know, the alternatives that we're the way out we're choosing, say, for EV cars, is going to be one that ignores the demands or needs of the subaltern in favor of ones that that conform to much more appealing green fantasies of a kind of global middle class to have EV cars and stuff, but not necessarily to have robust public transit and all these other things that would mean less mining, less extractivism of resources across the globe. So we basically, you know, keep producing the old inequalities of modernity now as a kind of green modernity. And that is, in a sense, the victory of a kind of capitalist development model that I think still needs to be unpacked and critiqued.
I'm with you on that. And the EV car is a great example of that. Not, you know, not just the production of these things, but also when they go wrong. You know, just a quick YouTube of these things catching fire, and you realize you've got a real you got a real problem on your hands when that occurs. Fellas, I've got to really tip my hat to you for putting this work together. I'm going to just weigh in strong and say that this should be a cornerstone book for any introduction to development studies, and certainly revisited at a graduate studies level. The very call for this to kind of live with that tension and explore the importance of when policies and practice go into the irrational and go into those promises and go into sort of that self-soothing is something that has been definitely undervalued and under-discussed in this discipline and others. And I really just have to give you a big nod to say that this work is going to be important for a lot of students, professors, researchers, and practitioners going forward. So that is Rethinking Development Politics by Alain Kapoor and Gavin Friedel. Fellas, final word to you.
Well, thanks so much. Well, we hope that, you know, this book will actually be read, and we hope that it will provoke. I mean, we're all up for debate on this. There are no easy answers politically and ethically. I would advise not just reading our book, but also, most importantly, if you're interested in psychoanalysis and psychoanalytic politics, please read Frantz Fanon, who I keep quoting, Black Skin, White Mask. It's one of the first books that blew my mind when I was a young university student. It remains one I constantly return to because it seeks to understand the psychoanalytic foundations of racism under French colonialism, and I think it remains so relevant today.
Thank you, Alain. Gavin, final word to you.
I agree with Alain. I think the point of the book is really to provoke, and you know, if we can get beyond the idea that there are easy answers or that there are perfect answers, then I think that opens up the door for us to having a better journey towards finding some answers once we abandon the idea that there's a clear pathway. And I just think if I was to mention, Alain mentioned Fanon, which is fantastic. So a more current book I really enjoyed was Todd McGowan's Capitalism and Desire. So I think that's a book that everybody should read to get a sense of the way that capitalism works, not just by imposing itself on us, but also by offering us fleeting opportunities to satisfy our desires. And maybe as a final plug, I'd also point out there's a new book coming out in the next couple months by Maureen So called Postcolonial Trauma and Development in Asia. And I've read a ton of her work, and Len and I have worked with her, and that's going to be a great book.
Fantastic. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us on GDP.
Thanks so much, Paul.
Thanks a lot.